Pengo sensed he was in for a difficult time. Now that he had exposed the story, he knew things were somehow beyond his control. At the same time, in finally coming out with it, he had unburdened himself, and in a way, he felt better. But this meant a new burden had landed on his shoulders, the weight of having set things in motion, of having betrayed the others in order to save himself. Yet he wasn't spending much time worrying about that. He was somehow sure that the others had their own plans for getting out of the predicament. Pengo entered into a form of receivership. The matter was an official case, with a specific no-nonsense agent from the Secret Service assigned as Pengo's official contact, and Pengo was expected to comply with any of the contact's demands. If the contact called and told Pengo to get on a plane the next morning for 2 days of interrogations in Cologne, Pengo was expected to put aside all other plans and do so. And the three television journalists who had pried his confession loose in the first place had taken a proprietary attitude toward the situation. Pengo got the impression that the journalists wanted to have at least one of the trio at his side during every waking moment, lest another journalist should start sniffing around the story. But as a practical matter, nothing really changed. Pengo's little company continued to take on sporadic work, and, much to his amusement, even did some consulting for the German commands of the armies of the United States and France and Berlin. He moved out of his father's place and into a small studio apartment of his own in Kreuzberg, a neighborhood known not only for its dense population of Turkish immigrants, but also as the focal point of Berlin's counterculture. It was a scene with strong appeal for Pengo. He had always felt that Berlin was the only place to live, and Kreuzberg had become the only place to live within Berlin. In fact, it seemed that those around Pengo, the German officials, the three journalists, and Sieber the lawyer, were exhibiting far more concern over the matter than Pengo himself. As if to thumb his nose at the entire Western establishment, just 2 weeks after his confession to the great consternation of those in the government working on the case, Pengo accepted an official invitation to consult for the Bulgarian Cybernetic Institute in Sofia. Before the trip, Pengo had to visit the institute's branch in East Berlin for a meeting. Remembering Sergei's invitation to come by whenever he liked, Pengo decided to try Carl's passport trick with his own, hoping to bypass the process of getting the one-day advance permission that was required of every West Berliner. Pengo went straight to passport control at Friedrichstrasse, handed the guard his passport, and said that he had an appointment. Unimpressed, the guard pushed the passport back at him and told the young West German to get the prior clearance. Either the trick worked only for Peter Karl, Pengo thought, or the Soviets had become alarmed by the attention Hess had attracted and now considered the espionage operation closed. The trip to Sofia was uneventful enough, at least as far as the work itself was concerned. Pengo donned a Yuppie outfit of jacket and tie and spent the week making formal presentations about computer networks to the Bulgarians, who seemed hungry for knowledge of any Western technology. Several months after Pengo's unexpected trip to the prosecutor's office and his confession, he discovered just how fortunate his timing had been. It turned out that Hagbard had done exactly the same thing at the advice of his own lawyer a few weeks before Pengo did. The handling of the two cases was strikingly parallel. Hagbard's lawyer, too, had invoked a section of the amnesty provision in the espionage laws and had his client turn himself in. It was a close call, to be sure. If Pengo had waited even another week, the authorities might have been ready to open a formal case against him and might not have offered him the promise of lenient treatment. A few weeks after Pengo's initial confession, the interrogations in Cologne became more intensive. His trips there usually consisted of an evening flight from Berlin to Cologne, where his contact would pick him up and deposit him at a hotel outside of the city. He was under strict instructions to make no telephone calls from his room. Promptly at 9 the next morning, the questioning would begin. It wasn't so much the idea of being beholden to the authorities that began to fray Pengo's nerves, but rather the psychological pressure his interrogators exerted. They played out a typical good cop, bad cop routine with him. One would cajole him while another threatened. They refused to believe that he hadn't done it for the money. Pengo could see they didn't understand that he had simply wanted to become the world's greatest hacker. He tried to explain what hacking was all about. He suggested they read Neuromancer, bearing in mind that his chances of getting off were vastly improved if he told the complete truth, Pengo tried to follow the Bayreuth lawyer's suggestion and be as forthcoming as possible, but there were times when his recall was less than perfect. Not only had 2 years elapsed since Pengo's one and only delivery to Sergei, but apparently the years of hash smoking had taken something of a toll on his memory. One pivotal subject on which Pengo was less than direct was that of the magnetic tape he had given to Sergei. Since he hadn't had the proper equipment for making such a tape, he had had to ask someone else to make it for him. That would have meant calling a friend and asking him to copy certain files from a computer onto the tape. Pengo had faced the basic technical problem of transferring information out of a computer in a portable form, and for that he had needed the cooperation of someone with access to the right equipment. At first, Pengo told his interrogators that he thought he had obtained the tape from Obelix in Hamburg, but as soon as he had suggested Obelix as a possible source of the tape, Pengo reversed himself and denied it. Perhaps he had second thoughts about implicating his friend, who could face harsh penalties if he were found to have collaborated, even unwittingly, with Pengo's spying adventure. Not only could Pengo not recall who had made the tape for him, but he claimed he wasn't sure what was on it. Pengo tried to explain that just as he had no tape-mounting equipment at his disposal, he also had no tape-reading equipment, so once he got the tape, he had no way of seeing what was on it. But the men questioning him were skeptical, perhaps to see if Pengo's sudden bouts with amnesia might be cured with a little gruff treatment. An agent from the Army's Secret Service branch attended one of the interrogations and scowled through the session. When Pengo's memory faltered, the military officer threatened that if Pengo continued with his evasive answers, he would flush the young hacker down the nearest toilet. Pengo was unperturbed, whereupon the Verfassungsschutz officers, more embarrassed than anything else, apologized to Pengo for their crusty military colleague. Still, the young Berliner was hardly relaxed about his fate, which now lay in the hands of the very authorities he had been trained to mistrust. But he had to laugh at the conspiratorial manner in which his interrogations were occasionally conducted. During one trip to Cologne, he was driven from the airport to a secluded patch of woods, where a second vehicle awaited him. Upon arrival, he was shown several photos of strangers and asked to identify them. Often, after a day of exhaustive questioning, the interrogators and their subject repaired to the hotel bar for a more relaxed probe into Pengo's political leanings. He was as frank with them as with anyone else. As Pengo saw it, these men were black and white people. They viewed communism simply as bad, while Pengo liked to believe he was more open-minded. Perhaps because of his upbringing, or perhaps because of his first-hand experience with the border life in Berlin, he recognized shades of gray in politics. If anything, he told them, he was a leftist. The authorities seemed always ready to listen to what Pengo had to say, if not quite ready to be converted to what they considered to be the young man's wayward political ideals. The interrogations continued through the summer of 1988, after which the Bundeskriminalamt, the investigative arm of the federal police and the rough equivalent of the American FBI, was on the case. For each new set of questioners, Pengo repeated his story. Time and again he was asked about how the whole affair was conceived and who made the initial contact with the Soviets. He was asked repeatedly to describe the core group of five that eventually emerged. Pengo said that he had come into the group later than the others, and that after his own delivery to Sergei, the Soviets' lack of feedback had disappointed and discouraged him. His involvement had diminished gradually, and by the time he engaged Sieber, he had been out of the business for more than a year. But he couldn't say what the others were doing, and he refused to comply with what he saw as unreasonable and irrelevant demands. When his Secret Service contact asked him to get them some information about Dobbs' trips to a Berlin brothel, Pengo refused in one blunt phrase, "I'm not your spy." In response to repeated demands for more detail about the precise workings of the group, Pengo insisted that he knew little about the others, with the exception of Hagbard and Dobb, and since their falling out over the rainbow and Dobbs' forgotten invoice, he had had very little contact with Dobb. He said he knew that Dobb owned a gun and could be dangerous. He believed that Carl had been over to East Berlin at least 24 times, and he knew that Dobb had gone at least once as well. He said that he knew Marcus Hess only vaguely, and that he had scant knowledge of Hess's breaking into Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. He said he might have been inside LBL computers himself once or twice, but he insisted that he knew nothing whatever of SDINet or the mysterious Laszlo Balo from Pittsburgh. To an outsider, Pengo might have maintained that he was perfectly at ease during the interrogation process, and that he was comfortable with being in league with the authorities. In fact, if he were asked to come up with a moral principle that guided his actions, he would have responded that he had been working for one side, and now he was working for the other. It was as simple as that. Morality was not really the issue. He continued to work at his little consulting company, which was in the process of merging with another small Berlin startup. But the effect of the interrogations was beginning to show. Even without Dobb as a supplier, Pengo's dependence on hash increased. Throughout the autumn, he was more often high than not, and he drank liters of coffee every day. He was a classic stress smoker, as the Germans say, lighting a cigarette, stubbing it out after two or three puffs, then lighting another one. He made dates with people and forgot about them, or simply sloughed friends off. When he bumped into his ex-girlfriend at a concert one night, he was skittish and jumpy and muttered something about being in trouble with the Secret Service. If Pengo was beginning to have a hard time with life as a snitch, the interrogations with the authorities were taking a deeper toll on Hagbard. Each of his attempts to overcome his dependence on drugs had failed. He was living in a halfway house at Hanover and had no money. His ever-narrowing circle of loyal friends was at a loss how to help him. When they were with him, he spoke of nothing but the great conspiracy that reigned over their lives, and there was little family support for Hagbard. His stepmother, his sole remaining parent, wanted to have little to do with him. Not only had he squandered his generous inheritance, but she was certain that he was selling some of the valuables he had inherited as well. More than once he had visited her and intimated that he would like to have certain paintings that had belonged to his father. She suspected that he planned to sell those as well, and told him she would no longer allow him inside the apartment if she was alone when he came. Hagbard had explained his predicament to Johann Sven, the Hamburg lawyer whom he had turned to for help. To Sven, the calm man with the soft voice didn't seem any more disturbed than other young people in trouble with the law. Sven was a prominent civil libertarian with a busy caseload. He had little time to make deep inquiries outside of what his client told him. Though very thin, with skin so pale it was nearly translucent, Hagbard was polite, self-consciously neat, and well-spoken. And in a sign to Sven that this young client had some sense of right and wrong, Hagbard hadn't been eager to betray his friends. Sven didn't inquire much into Hagbard's personal situation, and the young man offered no details.